So a few weeks ago we looked at some of the earlier parts of the book of Ecclesiastes, and I want us to consider another section of this book, this Old Testament book, this evening. The book of Ecclesiastes is actually a series of sermons. The writer of the book refers to himself in chapter 1, verse 1, as the preacher. And this man traditionally has been identified with Solomon, the great king of Israel. And in this book, he seeks to answer fundamental questions, or a fundamental question. Does life have any meaning? Does it have any purpose? And he comes at the question from two sharply contrasting viewpoints. Firstly, he comes at it from a viewpoint where God is not in the picture at all, where everything is seen purely from an earthbound perspective. And he comes to the conclusion that life lived without any reference to God is empty and meaningless. But then he comes at it from a second viewpoint, where he considers his existence and the existence of all human beings in the light of the reality of God. That he is the creator, that human beings were made by him, and that the purpose of their lives is to live in relationship with him and to do what pleases him. And because of that, their lives and how they live their lives have great significance. Well, here in chapter 11, Solomon is firmly in the territory of the second viewpoint. Life is not empty and pointless. There is meaning and purpose, but they are only to be found in knowing God and in living to bring glory to him. And in this chapter, Solomon gives wise counsel to all who wish to live that kind of life. And I'd like us this evening to consider what he has to say under three headings. First heading is, a wise life is a generous life. A wise life is a generous life. And this is verses 1 through to the first part of verse 3. So in these verses, Solomon commends to us generosity as a way of life. He's not talking here about a few isolated acts of giving, but a life where the basic attitude is that what we have been given is not to be kept for ourselves, but is to be used for the benefit of others. Solomon knows that's not something that comes naturally to us. Left to ourselves, we would place ourselves at the centre of everything. And all that we have, our money, our possessions, our time and our energy, would be used purely to promote our own interests. And so he brings a series of arguments to show that true wisdom will show itself in a generous attitude. And the first argument that he employs is that you won't ultimately lose out by being generous. And that's at the root of this rather strange picture that we have in verse 1, where he says, cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after several days. What might seem to be a futile, a pointless activity that's only going to result in loss will actually bring with it a great reward. There could be few more apparently pointless actions than taking bread. Something in the Bible that is symbolic of being of great value, of being basic and essential to life. Taking bread and throwing it into the sea. It seems like an act of complete folly. And yet isn't that so often how being generous seems to us? Putting the needs of others before our own. Using the things that are precious to us for the good of our fellow human beings. It's all too easy to imagine that we are going to be the poorer for it. And so we hold back. Perhaps we make a token gesture, but we don't really venture into the territory of real and costly generosity. But Solomon has learned something that he's anxious to communicate to us. What may seem like complete foolishness is actually true wisdom. Return to his picture for a moment. It goes against all your instincts. If you take your precious, life-giving, life-sustaining bread and recklessly toss it into the sea. But he says you may lose sight of it for a while, but the time will come when you will find it again. So being generous with your time, with your energy, with your financial resources, that can seem to be completely futile. You're never going to get back, are you, all that you've invested in that act of generosity? But God's economy doesn't work like that. At the very least, you will have the joy and the satisfaction of knowing that you're pleasing the Lord who loved you so greatly. And ultimately, no service or obedience, as we were reminded this morning, will be without its reward in the age to come. So it may seem like a complete waste of time to give yourself to visiting that housebound elderly person when there are so many other worthwhile and enjoyable things that you could be doing with your time. But when God is in the picture and your life is lived for Him, what seems like a waste to those around you can become a source of great blessing to you. But Solomon doesn't leave it there. He immediately follows this up with another argument. This time he anticipates a favourite strategy for avoiding generous giving. The thought that so easily comes to mind is, well, yes, I will give, but now is not the time. There will always be another opportunity. The argument that he uses against such thoughts is the uncertainty of life. Verse 2. Give a portion to 7 or even to 8, for you do not know what disaster may happen on the earth. You might very well intend to come back to that needy person next week or next month. But how do you know that you will be able to do so? Will that person still even be alive to receive your help then? Will you still be around to help them? Can you be sure that some catastrophe won't have happened that will make it impossible for you to carry out your good intention? To delay in doing good is a guaranteed way to ensure that it never happens. Even if disaster doesn't stop you from carrying out your intention, chances are that the next time the opportunity for doing good comes around, you will have found another reason to put it off. Of course, there may be very good and legitimate reasons why we can't immediately help somebody who is in need. But Solomon wants us to beware of the attitude that takes the future for granted. Only God knows the future. We certainly don't. So if we have the means and the opportunity to help another human being, then we should take it, because there's no guarantee that it will come our way again. And then thirdly, as he seeks to persuade us of the wisdom of a generous life, Solomon invites us to consider what we are here for. He asks us to look up into the sky, to look at the clouds and to consider, why are they there? Well, God has put them there, hasn't he? He's put them there for a purpose. And that purpose is to provide the earth with the rain that it needs. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. That's what clouds are there for. If the clouds with their rain are there to benefit the inhabitants of the earth, what about us? What are we here for? Why has God given us so much that's good? Are we really intended to hold on to it, to keep it for our own benefit? Or has he entrusted it to us so that we might use it for the good of others? Maybe in reminding us about the clouds, is Solomon perhaps inviting us to look beyond them to the one who made them? And to remind ourselves that he, our God, is the model of generosity par excellence. That he demonstrates his kindness on a staggering scale, not only to those who love and trust him, but to those who continue living in rebellion against him. So if this God has made us for himself, to live lives that glorify him, does it not follow that he will be most glorified when his kindness and his generosity are reflected in the lives of his people? Isn't it by transforming us from self-centered individuals to those who give freely to others that he rescues us from a meaningless and empty way of life and sets us on the path of purpose in his service. The second piece of advice that Solomon has for us this evening, as we consider how we are to live in the light of God's being, is that we should not wait for the perfect opportunity to do good. We should not wait for the perfect opportunity to do good. And this is the second part of verse 3 through to the end of verse 6. Solomon ponders his experience of life in this world, and he recognizes that one barrier that so often prevents people from doing the good that they should do is that they wait for the ideal circumstance, which never materializes. And so Solomon paints for us another picture. He invites us to think about a farmer who is about to go out and sow his seed. So it's a fine autumn day. The soil conditions are good. You go to see this farmer, and he's not out there in the field sowing his seed. Instead, he's sitting in his house, looking through the window. So you ask him, why isn't he taking this opportunity to sow next year's crop? Well, he tells you, it's too windy. I'm worried that the seed will get blown away. And then the next day comes, and he gets up early, planning to go out to the field. But he's stopped in his tracks. It's now raining and the ground is far too wet. He's missed the opportunity because he was waiting for the weather to be just right. Move on a few months and we come to the following year, and the grain is ready for the harvest. And again, it's a fine day, and the conditions are just right for gathering the crop. But the farmer is still not out in his field. Instead, he's anxiously looking up at the sky. It's not raining, but he can see some clouds on the horizon, and he's worried that it might rain later. And so he misses an opportunity, and who knows when he will get another. So what's the problem with our farmer? Well, it's simply that he's always waiting for the ideal conditions to do his work. And the thing he forgets is that the ideal conditions will never arrive. He needs to get on and sow his seed, even if the wind is a bit stronger than he would like. He needs to stop worrying about the clouds and get on with the harvest, at least while it's not raining. And because he's waiting for everything to be just right, he never actually gets anything done. Verse 4, he who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. Solomon wants his hearers to recognize that waiting for the perfect opportunity before we do good is a guaranteed way to end up not doing anything. In fact, he wants them to understand that in a fallen world, there are always going to be obstacles in the way, always going to be difficulties to overcome. And if we focus on the difficulties, then we will never accomplish anything of any value. We have to accept things are as they are. And accepting that, we have to get on and do the work that God has given us to do, trusting him for the grace to deal with the difficulties. I think that's what the second half of verse 3 is about. If a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. We might well wish that the tree hadn't fallen down in that particular place. After all, it's going to make it so much more difficult to get where we're going. If only it had fallen in the other direction, things would have been so much easier. Well, Solomon tells us to stop wishing, to accept things as they are. That's where the tree is. It's not going to move. We need to make the best of the situation. We need to make the necessary detour on our journey and carry on. At first glance, that might just sound like the sort of common sense advice that you would get from any of your friends or your neighbours, regardless of whether they know God or not. But we need to remember that Solomon here is looking at life with God in the picture. And there's a whole strand to his argument that no unbeliever would ever give you. That's in verse 5, where he says, as you don't know the way the spirit comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with child, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. You see, our problem is that we so often imagine that we know how things are going to work out. So we say to ourselves, well, if I embark on this Christian service, whatever it is, Now, when my circumstances are so difficult, I just can't see how any good is going to come of it. The whole thing will just unravel. The situation will be worse than if I'd never attempted it. Solomon says that if we think like that, we're forgetting the most important thing. We're leaving God out of the equation. I don't even understand the miracle of human life, how the tiny baby in its mother's womb is more than just a collection of molecules, how it's a living being created by God in his image. Well, if I don't understand that, how can I pretend to know how God will work out things in my difficult circumstances and as I take this opportunity to serve him? I'm thinking as though I'm in control of the events of my life, and only those things that I can understand, that I can rationalise or foresee, only those things will happen. Whereas the reality is, I'm dealing with a God who's able to take the most unpromising situations and bring about his amazing purposes through them. The Bible, of course, is packed full of examples of this kind of thing. Just one example: God, who took Sarah, a barren woman well past the years of childbearing, and made her the mother of a great nation from which all the nations of the earth will be blessed. So Solomon's advice is, take whatever opportunity you have to do good and leave the outcome with God. Verse 6, in the morning sow your seed, and at evening do not withhold not your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, this or that, or whether both alike will be good. So the situation in which you find yourself may be far from ideal. But if you have an opportunity to serve God in that situation, to help someone, to do good to someone, don't let those far from ideal circumstances hold you back. Remember that God is sovereign over your life. You don't know the outcome. There is no guarantee of what you might call success. Some things may not turn out as you would wish. But even then, you can have the confidence that God is in control and that whatever he does is good. But remember too that he is the God who delights to show his grace and power by using the weak and the disadvantaged and the disabled and the insignificant to bring about his great purposes. Perhaps this evening you're discounting the possibility of ever being used by God because of your health or your family situation or your work circumstances. And you say to yourself, well, if only my situation would improve, then I could do so much. Let me say to you, don't let the fact that there are things that you can't do stop you from doing the things that you can do. Remember that the God you serve is able to take the small and the apparently insignificant things and bring about far greater things through them. And then the third piece of wisdom and advice that Solomon has for us is in verses 7 to 10, where we learn that life is a good gift to be enjoyed. Life is a good gift to be enjoyed. So Solomon has been keen to remind us that our circumstances in this life will never be ideal. But that's not to say that we are to view life in this world in purely negative terms. It is a precious gift from God, and therefore it is to be enjoyed as such. Verse 7, light is sweet and it is pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. So if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all. God has created this amazing world containing many wonderful things. He has made us living beings with the capacity to appreciate and to enjoy all of his creation. So we should not be ascetics, people who regard the material universe and all that it contains as having little value. A long life in this world is not something to be despised. If that's what God has ordained for us, we should embrace it and use it to the full. And as he makes this point, it seems that Solomon particularly has his younger hearers in mind. Verse 9, rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. So young people are setting out on life's adventure, and they have strength and vigour and the ability to explore and to enjoy the wonder of the world around them. And to some extent at least, they are free from the cares and the burdens that come with later life. And Solomon counsels them to take full advantage of these things while they have them, to use them to the full. They have strong desires, they have dreams and ambitions. Those things are not to be suppressed, but as God gives and enables, they should do all that they can to fulfill them. Perhaps as older Christians, our tendency at times has been to focus so much on the snares and the dangers that come with life in this fallen world, that we give young people the impression that to enjoy themselves and to pursue their goals is questionable at least, and at worst, the opposite to what God really intends for them. Well, Solomon doesn't have any time for such a view. He, perhaps more than anyone, has explored the delights that this present world has to offer. And true, yes, he has concluded that if they are pursued for their own sake, without reference to God, then they're empty and meaningless. But when they're recognised for what they are, the kind gifts of the Creator, then they're to be received with gladness and thankfulness. They're to be embraced and enjoyed. Solomon does introduce some caveats, some things that we should take note of. Firstly, we need to remember that the good things of this life are not permanent. Experience of life in this fallen world is not one of uninterrupted enjoyment. We should embrace the good times and use the opportunities that they provide. But we should also remember that there will be darker days and that we need to be ready for them. Verse 8. So if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all, but let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. The sun is shining on you now. You are young. You enjoy good health. Life is relatively straightforward. You have many opportunities that you're able to pursue. But you should remember that life won't always continue that way. Dark days will come. Clouds will obscure the sunlight. You will encounter obstacles and difficulties and heartaches. And even now, as you rejoice in the good times, you need a view of life that will prepare you for those days too. We need to understand that the joys of life that now seem so solid and permanent won't last forever. The time will come when sooner or later when they will vanish. That's what Solomon is driving at the end of verse 8 and again at the end of verse 10, where he says, all that comes is vanity. Youth and the dawn of life are vanity. It may feel as though you're going to be young forever with an endless supply of health and vigour. Solomon says these things are vanity. What he means by that is that they're insubstantial. They're like the morning mist that evaporates when the sun comes up. Sooner or later you will experience pain and difficulty in your life. And the time will come when you look back over your youth and wonder where it's gone. Again, you need an outlook on life that is robust enough to stand up to that reality. But then there's another thing that you need to keep in mind. One day you'll have to give an account to God of the life that you've lived in his world. Verse 9, walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes, but know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. So God has given you many good things to enjoy, dreams to follow, ambitions to pursue. But a day will come when he calls you to give an account to him of how you have used his gifts. That day may at the moment seem like a distant prospect, but it will come. Your whole approach to life now needs to keep that day firmly in your sights. Have you taken God's gifts and just used them selfishly for your own ends, viewing them as yours to do with as you please? Or have you recognised that they are gifts from him and therefore to be used to bring pleasure to him? Solomon follows this up in verse 10 with a warning. He says, remove vexation from your heart and put away pain or evil from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are vanity. When you're young and everything seems to be going swimmingly, there's a strong temptation to think that you're indestructible, to live as though things are going to continue as they are forever. And you forget about God and the fact that one day you will face his judgment, and you begin to rebel against him in your thoughts and in your actions. Well, Solomon wants you to recognize that rebellious thoughts and actions might seem to have no impact on you while you're young. You can live as you please without any serious consequences. But youth won't last forever, and the time will come when you'll have to face up to reality. To look back over a self-centered and rebellious life with regret, and to look forward to the solemn prospect of standing before the God against whom you've rebelled. I want to speak in particular to any children and young people amongst us this evening, and I'll leave you to decide whether you fall into that category. Do you recognise that your life is a precious gift from God, a gift that he wants you to enjoy? Whoever you are, he has given you gifts, abilities and opportunities that he calls you to use to the full. Maybe you enjoy sport and you're good at it. Well, thank him for that gift. Work and train hard. Be the best that you can, because you want to please God and bring him glory. Maybe you enjoy spending time with people. You find that you can relate well to others and understand them. Again, recognize that that is God's gift to you, whether in your daily work or in the church or amongst your friends. Use it to help and to encourage others and to support those with particular needs. Perhaps you have academic ability. Employ that to gain a better understanding of the world that God has made. Don't be half-hearted about your studies. Pursue them vigorously. Consider what you can best do with them to glorify God. Maybe you're not particularly conscious of being gifted in any area. You may have some interest or hobby. Thank God for that. Ask him to help you to use it for his glory. Whatever your situation, take opportunities to serve God now while you're young. Remember, you won't always have the strength and the ability that you have now, so make the most of it while you have it. Remember that this life is short, and that the time will soon come when you have to stand before God and give an account to him of how you've used your time and your energy. But maybe this evening your problem is that God is not in the picture for you. You've up to this point been trying to live your life without him. You may have been doing it subtly, but you've been all the time rebelling against him in your thoughts, your words and your deeds. You fail to recognize that all the good things that you have are gifts from him, and that your life can only have meaning and purpose when you know him and live to please him. Well, let me urge you not to let things carry on like that any longer. The only way to know a purposeful and meaningful life of the kind we've been thinking about this evening is to know this God who made you for himself, to enter into a relationship with him. The problem is, of course, that sin and rebellion have cut you off from God and have prevented you from coming near to him. But he has taken the initiative. He hasn't left things like that. He has made himself known in his Son, Jesus Christ. And crucially, he's dealt with the problem of human sin by punishing his Son in the place of sinners on the cross. So if you will come to Jesus this evening and put your trust in him, then that barrier of your sin will be removed, and you can enter into a relationship where you know this God, you know him as your heavenly Father, and you're then set free to live the only kind of life that's worth living. Amen.